Good evening and welcome, everyone. On May 7, 2013, it was widely reported, especially in the American press, that there had been a prominent American rabbinical leader who had spoken about Rabbi Lipman. But as opposed to how we'll introduce him this evening, perhaps in not as generous a light as perhaps one might have anticipated, this particular rabbi termed Rabbi Lipman, I didn't call him necessarily Rabbi Lipman, termed even a Russia, and Shoshana Upiresh, someone who had learned and then somehow veered off the path. Now, I refer to this this incident obviously not only not to to condone or to echo that sentiment, and not only to certainly to reference just how interesting Rabbi Lipman's life has become, but really as a sign of appreciation for the kind of lumps that people in leadership positions really undertake. And there's no question that over the course of the last number of years, Rabbi Lipman has gone from someone who in many ways perhaps represents all of us, an American who made a decision to go and to share his destiny with Klal Yisrael, Medinat Yisrael, taking the values of religious Zionism and living them for himself and for his family, but then suddenly being transformed into almost a figurehead for an entire movement that sought to create greater bridges between the secular and religious communities, and along the way, who met perhaps criticism at times, but of course it's only those who are criticized who actually are in position to make a difference, because otherwise they don't bother saying things, those kinds of things about people like you and me. So it's really, I think, speaks very much to Rabbi Lipman's influence and his role in not only our community, but certainly in a global sense. And in that way, he's really distinguished himself. Jews, we had been looking to bring Rabbi Lipman in to come back to speak to our students, as he did so movingly earlier today, and to the community as well. But it would not have been without Rabbi Gross's connection. So I want to thank you for making the shidduch, and we very much appreciate that. I also want to take an opportunity to welcome Rabbi Gabay back to Kohelet Yeshiva High School. It's always a tremendous honor to have you with us here this evening. And so on that note, and in appreciation for everything that you've done and taken on behalf of Medinat Yisrael and Klal Yisrael, it's a tremendous privilege and pleasure to call upon Rabbi Lipman. Just a housekeeping note, the schedule will be, he'll speak for approximately 45 minutes, open it up for questions. Afterward, there will be books on sale here for just $15, an American MK, all welcome, and they'll be signed in addition. We'll also be holding a Ma'ariv Minyan in the Beit Midrash immediately following the presentation. Without further ado, Rabbi Dov Lipman.
Thank you so much for the introduction, and I really want to thank, first of all, Rabbi Gross for the hospitality throughout the day, and I think my wife would be jealous about how much time we spent together over the course of a day, but we really got to spend time together, and I really appreciate all the efforts that you made. A big thank you to Rabbi Sinensky, to Rabbi Pearl for the hospitality here in Kohelet as well. Many people ask me, as a starting point in any conversation, they ask me what led my wife and myself to pick up and even move to Israel to begin with, to sort of start our story, which led to me ending, being in the Knesset. And I don't really have a thought-out, intelligent answer to give to explain what happened. I was teaching at the Berman Hebrew Academy in Rockville, Maryland, and the school went on a school mission to Israel. And they needed to have teachers chaperone the students, and we volunteered to be part of that process and to go to Israel. And the purpose of the trip was to connect the students to Israel. Now, I don't know if they succeeded or failed in that mission, but they did a really good job of connecting the faculty to Israel. And we started out up north, and we worked our way towards Yerushalayim. And about 5 days into the trip, we were on this bus making our way at nighttime up the hills towards Yerushalayim. And they had a recording of Naomi Shemer singing Yerushalayim Shel Zahav on throughout the bus. And my wife and I were sitting next to each other, and there were tears just going down our cheeks. So I played the role of a very proud male, and I said, boy, these allergies are really something in the Jerusalem hills this time of year. But at a certain point, I had no choice but to confront the reality that something very, very deep was pulling at us, and we felt our oldest child at the time was 6. This was the time to try to make the move. And thank God I was fortunate to find positions teaching in post-high school programs in Israel. And that's it. We were going to make Aliyah. And I had to call my grandmothers to tell them that we're making this move. And very, very difficult phone calls to make. So first I called my grandmother in Florida, who we didn't see so often. And I called her up and I said, "Grandma, I have some news for you. This coming summer, God willing, we're going to be moving to Israel." And boy, did she give it to me. And every single thing she said was right. She said, "I'm not going to see you. I'm not going to see my great-grandchildren. How could you do this to me?" It was a very, very difficult phone call. Then I had to call my grandmother, who in New York, who God willing I'll see tomorrow. Thank God she's still alive. She's a Holocaust survivor. She was in New York. We drove up all the time to see her. She knew my children very well, and I had to tell her they were moving to Israel. And I said, "Bubby, I have some news for you. I was offered a position to teach in Israel, and God willing this summer we're moving to Israel." And I was prepared. She knows how to speak her mind. And there was a pause, and my grandmother said, "Baruch ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Shechiyanu V'kimanu V'giyanu Lazman Hazeh." I said, "Bubby, where did that come from? I wasn't expecting that." And she said, "I want to tell you something." She said, "When we were on the boat going from DP camp in Germany to the United States, the entire way I asked myself, why are we going in that direction? We should be going in the other direction where a new Jewish state is being born." And she said, "And even though I have no complaints about the experience that we had in the United States, it was a haven for us. We rebuilt our family. We lived as Jews openly with no anti-Semitism, no complaints whatsoever." She said, "To know that her grandchildren and great-grandchildren are going to be settling in the land of Israel, she has nothing but thanks to God for that happening." That blessing of my grandmother is something which I hold with me every single day. Because it's not easy to make Aliyah. There are a lot of challenges along the way. You get involved politically in Israel. You see things on an even deeper level about how much we have to fix. But it's always with that perspective of that Shachianu, and that's why it's important for you to hear that before we even begin to talk about the issues that we're talking about tonight. And there we were a few months later, July 2004. At JFK Airport, this goodbye ceremony, and it was the Nefesh B'Nefesh, second flight of Nefesh B'Nefesh. We had this goodbye ceremony at the airport. We said goodbye to our parents. Felt like I was extracting my children from their grandparents. And we're on this flight, and we're getting our children settled in the plane. Everyone on this flight is making Aliyah. We were privileged to have the youngest passenger on that flight, my daughter, who at that time was 7 weeks old, and we're celebrating her bat mitzvah in just a few weeks. And the oldest passenger was 80 plus years old, and all of us are there making Aliyah together. And the pilot begins to speak to us from the cockpit, and he goes through the regular routine that we hear from any pilot when we fly anywhere. And at the end he says, "Everybody sit back, relax, and enjoy the flight. I'm here to take you home." And he said that, and somehow in the entire process of preparing to make Aliyah, I never thought about it in those terms. He just hit it right on the mark. After 2,000 years of our family going from country to country, from continent to continent, and in every single one of them, except for our experience here in America, we were either thrown out or ran away. Here we were, by choice, not running away from something, but running to something and going back home. And I think about those words on a pretty regular basis as well. My family moved to Beit Shemesh, and for those of you who have followed the story of Beit Shemesh in the news, you'll chuckle when you hear why I chose Beit Shemesh. I was there on a pilot trip, and my cousin drove me around. And I saw so many different types of Jews in Beit Shemesh. There was Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox, secular, Russians, Ethiopians, religious Zionists, English speakers. And I called my wife and I said, "We have to live in Beit Shemesh to show our children the miracle of the ingathering of the exiles and how Jews from all over the world can live together in this city in perfect harmony and unity. This is the place that we have to live." And I learned pretty quickly that this wasn't the case. We moved to a country which was 56 years old, and nothing short of a miracle, an amazing country, and everything was handed to us on a silver platter. We had education for our children, health services, transportation, built through blood, sweat, and tears, and I never stop thanking native Israelis for all the work they put into building this country and giving it to us. Here, enjoy this wonderful country. But there's one thing we haven't figured out how to get right, and that's how do you take Jews from 2,000 years of different national, cultural, religious experiences, put them in this small little geographic area we call Israel, and find a way to get along with one another. There were a few different episodes that really shocked me into this reality. The first, which really led to my first political activity in Israel, was I woke up one morning to go jogging, and as I'm running around our neighborhood, there were these bright yellow signs all over the neighborhood, plastered on walls throughout the neighborhood, which said in Hebrew, it's forbidden for women to walk on this street in clothing deemed immodest. Like, what in the world is this? Where are these signs coming from? Who's putting up these signs? And what, in the name of what God and what religion what is going on over here? And it bothered me. And I came home from work that day, and the signs were still there. And I walked over to one of the signs, and I tried to pull it off, and they know how to glue these things on really, really well. I could not get it off. So I went to a store, and I bought spray paint. And I got up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I went around the neighborhood, and I spray painted over all the signs. I felt like there's no reason for women in our neighborhood to wake up tomorrow morning and have these signs staring at them in the face. A few days later, the signs came back. And I got up again early in the morning, and I spray painted over all the signs. A few days later, they came back again. And spray paint cost more, I mean, it was more money than I realized, and I was using canisters of paint. So I woke up again, and I went to the signs, and all I did was spray paint over the last two words on the sign. And now the signs read, it's forbidden for women to walk on the street in clothing. And an amazing thing happened. The signs never came back again. And for me, that experience was incredibly empowering. Put aside my little sense of humor and my little gimmick, I felt like little me. I had no political connections whatsoever. I had nobody to turn to help us. But I was able to push back against something which I thought was wrong, and something which I saw as a chilul Hashem, as desecrating God's name, instead of being anything which represented holiness. And over the years of Beit Shemesh, things got worse, and I really became an activist. I tried at first to be a mediator. I came with this American, you know, can't we all just get along approach, we'll talk this through, and everything will be fine, and I failed miserably. And along the way, I learned how deep this issue goes. This is not just some simple issue of how people dress in Beit Shemesh. This goes to the core of the question of what does it mean to have a Jewish state? And I discovered that in May 1948, David Ben-Gurion stood up and very courageously declared Israel as a Jewish state. According to his writings, it seems that he thought that by November of that year, we would have peace with our Arab neighbors, and that at that point, we'd start focusing on the internal issues of what do we want out of this country. And sadly, we haven't had peace from that moment until today. And we're so focused on our survival, on security issues, that the issues of what does it mean to have a Jewish state, and what should the state stand for, and what is Jewish in a Jewish state, we haven't really dealt with those issues as a nation. And along the way, I would say that definition and understanding what Jewish means in Israel has been hijacked. By one particular group, which has one understanding of how it should be. And as a result, I travel around Israel, and these are the words that shook me to the core. I met secular Israelis, and young people in particular, and they said the following. First they said, we hate Judaism. Think about that for a moment. After 2,000 years, we've returned to our homeland, we're building a Jewish state, and young people en masse are saying we hate Judaism, but there's a second half to the sentence. They say, and we hate that we hate Judaism. They're not looking for a way out, they're looking for a way in. But we have closed that door by presenting them with a Judaism and a religion and a faith which they don't really have any interest in. So I decided that I wanted to get involved in politics, and I'm not going to get into the whole story of how this developed. I was not thinking at all about being a member of Knesset. I didn't think it was possible. I didn't think it was possible on a number of levels. First and foremost, Hebrew. I still speak with a very heavy American accent. I refuse to try to sound like an Israeli. I'm proud of where I come from, no matter how it sounds to the Israeli ear. Grammar, the masculine, the feminine, it's just an impossibility. And then you finally master it, and you find out that the numbers are the exact opposite of what it should be. And I actually joked when I got to the Knesset that I wanted to pass legislation to change the numbers back to the way they should be, so that I could be right 100% of the time and everybody else can be wrong. And so Hebrew-wise, I couldn't imagine. And also, you see on TV how in the Knesset, people yell at each other and scream at each other and interrupt each other. I'm this quiet American who raises my hand and says, excuse me and please and thank you. And I didn't even imagine functioning in that world. I just wanted to be involved. I wanted to be involved, and I wanted to bring a voice that I viewed. Of course, we always think that we're the voice of reason. The way I saw the voice of reason to this issue, especially about the conflict between the religious and the secular in Israel, try to break down barriers and try to create unity, try to bring the Haredi community, the ultra-Orthodox community, into Israeli society without sacrificing anything religiously along the way, which is something I believe in with passion. And I wanted to get involved. And the last name that I didn't even think about when I thought about getting involved politically was Yair Lapid. All I had heard about Yair Lapid was negative. I heard that he's anti-Torah, he's anti-religion, he's anti-Haredim, he's an anti-Semite. These are the things that you hear. And I won't get into the full story. I got to meet him. I got to meet him, and I sat with him. And I always say, as if whenever I read the criticism about Yair, I wish every person could have 5 minutes to sit and talk with him. And within 5 minutes, they'd realize that it's all ridiculous in terms of the exaggerated form that people are criticizing him. And I told him, you know, he's very secular, I'm very religious, we connected on a very deep level. He said his passion is to work together with religious people to try to generate unity in Israel and find a new contract between the religious and secular in Israel. And I said, Yair, I'm on board, this is what I want to do, this is my passion. And I started a branch of his new party called Yesh Atid in Beit Shemesh. At a certain point, some of his advisors asked for my resume, and I realized they were considering me to be on the list for the Knesset. He offered me to be number 17 on the list, which was not realistic at all. At the time, the party was polling at about 5 seats, 6 seats, and I accepted it with tremendous honor. I just wanted to be involved, and especially the legislation about bringing the ultra-Orthodox into the army. I wanted to make sure there was a religious voice involved in that process. I just wanted to be involved. And there we were on election night, celebrating 19 seats. We were the second largest party in the Knesset, and woke up the next day with a tremendous burden I felt on my shoulders. You know, over 500,000 people went and voted for us and are expecting us to carry out what we promised, and we set out to work to try to make that happen. All 19 of us in the party were new to the Knesset, so the party set up Knesset school where we learned what does it mean to be a member of Knesset. It was an intensive week where you have to learn everything about how do you take an idea and turn it into a law, how do the committees work, what is the schedule like, all of these things that you never even heard about just to be a member of the Knesset. I will tell you that during that week, I wrote to my political science teacher from high school in America, and I said to her, Mrs. Wolf, now I see the wisdom of the founding fathers of the United States of America, because boy, is it complicated in the parliament that I'm going to be working in. About a week before the inauguration, I came home, and there was a letter waiting for me from the Knesset. I was so excited, an official letter from the Knesset, what can this be? And I opened it up, and it said that according to Israeli law, I cannot be sworn in as a member of Knesset unless I renounce my American citizenship. And I remember exactly where I was standing, and I was actually shaking as I read this letter. I come from a very patriotic American family. My father, blessed memory, was a federal judge. My father-in-law was a U.S. Army chaplain for over 30 years. My wife grew up many years in West Point at the U.S. Military Academy. Very proud American family. And I had to go to the embassy and renounce my citizenship. There were two of us who had to do it. And for those of you who know Israeli politics, you'll appreciate this. It was myself and Naftali Bennett. And Naftali was like skipping and dancing and throwing a kiddush over the fact that he could renounce his American citizenship. And it was very painful for me to do it. I will tell you that a few hours after doing it, there was a realization that set in, where I thought to myself, you know, 2,000 years ago, my ancestors were living in this land as citizens of a kingdom of some form in this land. And here I am, after 2,000 years, I'm Israeli. And I was reminded that yesterday morning when I waited in the long line at Newark Airport to get into the United States of America. But I was Israeli, I'm going to the Knesset, and we were sworn in the next week, and it was time to get to work. And being a member of Knesset was nothing like I imagined it would be on so many levels. You know, every single day we drove to that building, and every day as the car turned the corner and I saw the building in front of me, I give thanks to God for the opportunity. You know, here I am, instead of sitting back every Shabbat and complaining about things in my country, I'm in a position to actually do something about it. And on issues that bothered me, I could actually try to write legislation and try to make real change. And it's an incredible position to be in and an incredible blessing. You walk into the building, you check in with the security, and if you've ever visited the Knesset, you'll see that there are these boards all around with the faces of the members of Knesset that light up if a member of Knesset is there. It's also available on computer. And there were days that I'd wake up and my mother from Silver Spring would call me and say, "Why aren't you at work today?" Because she was checking up on me to see if I was there. But you check in with the security and it's just complete chaos from that moment until sometimes 2-3 o'clock in the morning. You don't even know what happened. You're running from committee hearing to votes, to party meetings, to media appearances, one after another, and it's just literally nonstop. You almost don't have a moment to catch your breath. And as I divide up, you know, the different responsibilities that we had, there's no doubt that the most important thing for me was helping to write the legislation of the draft. The Supreme Court required the Knesset to write a new law which had some level of equality regarding the Haredi community and serving in the military. And that was a big focus of mine during that time. And I think that we wrote a law which was very fair and very actually pro-Haredi, in my opinion. It doesn't say that every 18-year-old Haredi has to go and serve in the army at 18 years old. It says that between the ages of 18 and 24, there are goals per year of how many Haredim have to serve in the army. By the way, we met along the way with rabbis on the highest of levels in the Haredi community. And the deal was before we met with them that we can't reveal to anyone who we met with. So I apologize that I can't do that, but you can just imagine in your minds who those names might be. And they were overall they worked together with us on the law, and we got some numbers from them in terms of how many boys are really, truly studying Torah day and night. Remember, the exemption comes because Torah Tohum Nato. Torah Tohum Nato means all I want to do day and night is study Torah. If you go back to the classic sources, there are sources that say people who are Torah Tohum Nato don't stop to daven because all they want to do is learning. So they're not sitting in the falafel place on Thursday nights, and they're not sitting in the Knesset audience and watching us for a few hours on a Wednesday afternoon. All they want to do is study Torah. And we wrote a law which I think was very fair. Thank God the goals have been met, both in terms of army service and national service, which we put in there as well. The current government tinkered with the law. It wasn't a total change from what we wrote, but it did change it somewhat. But that, from my perspective, was a huge success. I was the head of the Knesset task force to help Haredim get to work. From my perspective, that was the most important thing that we could do. First of all, take families that are living in poverty on the highest of levels, and help them support their families with dignity. Give them training and help them find jobs. But even beyond just helping them support their families with dignity, which everyone should have the opportunity to do, I really believed that when we talk about all the broader religion and state issues in Israel, and the issue of extremism, and the issue of pushing away secular Israel, the more Haredim would become part of Israeli society, again, not sacrificing along the way their commitment to studying Torah, not sacrificing where they are religiously, but you just recognize that you can be part of society and become more moderate along the way. You're no longer isolated where everyone else outside of your community is bad. They live a different way of life than you do, but you start meeting good, decent people. And amazing things started happening. I convinced CEOs to hire Haredim, and I got reports back which were just incredible. I'm not suggesting that we've reached complete utopia yet, but to hear about Haredim who are working, who made a bar mitzvah in a Haredi neighborhood and invited all the secular people in their company to come, if you understand the Haredi community in Israel, that's an unbelievable development that someone would feel the courage to do that. And the Chilonim, who had to find witnesses for their chuppah and ask the Haredim that they're working with, because this is the first time that there was interface between these communities. Secular Israelis, for the first time, are meeting Haredim, and they're realizing that the Haredi community in Israel is not the crazy extremist in Beit Shemesh who's throwing something at someone or putting up these signs. That's not who they are. They're wonderful people. And Haredim, for the first time, are meeting Chilonim, and they're realizing, okay, they're not religious Jews, they don't live my lifestyle, but they're also good, upstanding people. And down the road, as this trend continues, and there's a silent revolution, a quiet revolution happening in the Haredi street, we started where we've helped over 3,500 Haredim get training, get jobs, and one friend tells another. I'll never forget the moment this Belzer Chassid came into my office to thank me for helping him get a job. His wife made this little gift basket, which I had to give to the Knesset Ethics Committee because we can't take gifts. And he said, "Thank you so much." He said, "I went to work for a month, and all of a sudden this huge amount of money was put into my bank account." And this light bulb went off in his head about the connection between going to work and earning a decent living. And he tells his friend, and his friend tells his friend. And the biggest moment for me, when I realized we can actually do this, I would go all the time on Haredi media to voice my opinions and to make the case for Haredim going to work and getting a basic general education. And it was one night, I was in Radio Kol Chai, primetime radio, which is where Haredi families don't have televisions, and they gather around the radio and listen to the news. And the host says to me, "How can you, as a religious rabbi, possibly suggest that they should leave Kollel and go to work? How can you say that?" So I said to him, "Can I read from Maimonides for a moment? Can I read from the Rambam?" And he said, "Sure." And I don't want to get into the inner workings of, because people always have answers for this Rambam. But the Rambam says it. What can I tell you? In Hilchot Talmud Torah, the Rambam says straight out, and all I did was read it. The Rambam says, a person who chooses to study Torah and forces other people to support him, meaning, if you have the wealth and you have the ability and you want to study Torah, go for it. But if you force other people to support you, the Rambam says that person has brought shame, has disgraced God, brought shame to the Torah, and loses the portion of the world to come. I just read it. There was a pause, and the host says to me, "You're quoting from Maimonides from like 1,000 years ago? How is that relevant today?" That was a breakthrough moment for me, because I realized there are no answers to what I'm saying. In Judaism, we always believed in going to work and supporting your family. And the greatest rabbis were always worldly scholars, and they always went to work and had jobs. And I would stand at the Knesset podium and just read them. Just read the sources, and I tuned out whenever anybody was yelling at me, and I'm just reading the sources. And thank God we had tremendous success, and thank God that process has continued even beyond our time in the government. So that's the issue of task forces and trying to make changes there. As members of Knesset, we have the ability to write laws. And I mean, the book is filled with stories about different laws and what happened along the way in trying to pass them. I want to share one example with you. So as I mentioned, religion and state was a big issue for me. And I was not aware of this issue before I became a member of Knesset. But as I started holding meetings for people who wanted to meet with me, women would come and tell me their stories as agunot in Israel. And I have to tell you, it broke my heart. I was shattered by it, by the situation where women weren't getting a get and what to do about this problem. They want to get remarried, and how do they do so? And I thought to myself, my goodness, we have our own state. We can do whatever we want to do to try to solve these problems. So I went to meet with Rabbi Lau, the current chief rabbi, and who I've been close to over the years. And I said to him, what can we do? I have an idea. Is there anything that I can actually successfully pass? So he said to me, "You know what, Dov?" He said, "There are 15 guys who are actually sitting in jail because they haven't given their wife a get. It's so bad that the state actually arrested them. But in jail, there is something which is called the Agaf HaTorani, of the Israel prison system. They're in the Torah division of jail. What does that mean? They wake up every morning, they have shacharit, they have a breakfast, and they sit in an air-conditioned Beit Midrash, lined with sfarim, and they study Torah all day. And there's no pressure on them whatsoever to give their wives a get. And let's remember, throughout our history, Jewish communities knew how to pressure people to give their wives a get, and here we're giving them this beautiful lifestyle in prison. So I said to him, I'm going to write a law that says that if you are in jail because you did not give your wife a divorce, you cannot claim to be religious and be in the Agaf Torani. He said he'll support that law. And I wrote the law, and then Rabbi Lau actually called me and said, add one more thing to the law. I said, what's that? He said, add to the law that they cannot have Mahadran kosher food. He said, they can't have Mahadran. He said, I know of two guys who will give their wives a get the next day if you take away the Mahadran food. So I said, okay, we wrote the law. The first step in writing a law is it has to go to the Knesset attorney. The Knesset attorney is the one who, if your law ever goes to the Supreme Court, he's the one who has to be able to argue it for the Knesset. So he has to basically give you the green light and say, I can argue this case in the Supreme Court. It went to the Knesset attorney. I got a call a few weeks later from the Knesset attorney's office. The Knesset attorney himself wants to meet with me, which is unusual. He has a large staff. I go in to meet with him, and he says, Dov, I cannot support this law. I said, are you kidding me? Why can't you support this law? He said, I don't understand. Somebody who, God forbid, somebody who murders somebody, they can be in the Torah division of jail, but a guy who doesn't give his wife a get can't? Explain that to me. So thank God I have years of studying in yeshiva and Talmudic jurisprudence, and I wish that the transcript of this conversation, which was ours, could have been recorded for historical purposes. And I basically argued the following. I said, somebody who, God forbid, murders somebody, theoretically, 5 minutes later, an hour later, a week later, a year later, he could regret what he's done. And he can do tshuva for what he's done. He should be in jail for the rest of his life as a punishment, but you can regret what you've done. This guy who hasn't given his wife a get, every single moment that he's in jail, he's continuing to sin, he's continuing to abuse her, and he hasn't repented from what he's done, and he can't claim to be religious. So he bought my argument, and it moves on to the next step, where it goes to the Ministerial Committee of Legislation, where the ministers have to vote to say, we will allow this law to go to the floor of the Knesset. And there, sure enough, it went into an obstacle of the secular ministers, including members from my party, who said, we cannot support the clause about the Mahadran food. They said, human rights, people have the right to eat whatever they choose. I said to them, I promise you the food is kosher. I promise they can eat the food. I won't go into all the inner workings of the kashrut situation in Israel. They refused. So I had to agree to take off that clause. The law passed its first reading in the Knesset, and then unfortunately the government disbanded before it had a chance to move forward. It's now moving forward in the 20th Knesset, and hopefully it will become law. But it gives you an example of some of the inner workings where you think you have a law which is ironclad and can pass through, and there are so many examples of it, and then there are all kinds of obstacles along the way. You essentially, if you want to pass a law in the Knesset, you essentially have to lobby every single minister on that committee. Because if one minister wants to stop the law, they can spend a lot of political capital, but they can stop, every minister can stop the law. And that's, by the way, why in the 19th Knesset, that's why we formed a government without the Haredi parties. It wasn't because we don't like them, it's because if they're in the government, we can't move anything on religion and state issues because they can put their foot down and say no. So this gives you an example in terms of the laws, and you try to make changes in that way. Committee work is absolutely crazy in terms of the hours that you spend in committee. I was a member of the finance committee. You know, talk about my fear of Hebrew. I finally conquered it. I studied, I'll tell it to you this way. The Knesset gives a budget to every member of Knesset to learn a second language. Some use it for English, some for Arabic, some for Russian. I made history. I used my budget for Hebrew. And every Sunday from 1 to 3, I sat with my tutor, Nadav, and we went over my speeches from that week, and he drilled me on it, and worksheets, and homework. And it really showed me that through hard work, you can actually, for the most part, master a language. I wouldn't say that I got to the point where I feel the way I speak in English, but I'm able to pretty much express myself in any way. My biggest fear as a member of Knesset was that I would stand there at the podium on TV and say something and I'd become the laughingstock of the country. And I was afraid every time I spoke at the Knesset podium, I was afraid that that would happen. There was only one word that I messed up in the entire time, and it wasn't too bad. There's a Haredi woman who became a dean in Bar-Ilan University, and I wanted to praise her publicly for that accomplishment. And the Hebrew word for a dean is for a female, she's a dikanit. And as I read my speech, I called her a dikanit, which I guess could mean someone who's very precise and very careful about her words. But either way, people understood what I was saying, and it wasn't something which really caught on anywhere. But then all of a sudden I go to the finance committee, and there's a whole new world of a whole new lexicon of terminologies. And I would sit there at night for hours poring over those documents and trying to understand what they mean. And I actually sat there, I wouldn't say this publicly in Israel, but I sat there in the committee with my iPad there, and I had right there on the screen a website which is a big blessing from God called Morphix. And if a word came up that I didn't understand, I'd put it in right away, and I'd get in on the conversation about 10 seconds late, but at least I would know what they were talking about. But you run from committee to committee and from vote to vote, and at times, just because of manpower issues, they actually ask you to vote on things and you have absolutely no idea what the vote's about. And it's very, very disconcerting. It was very hard for me. And I would always insist, as they were running me from one room to another, to at least tell me what the vote was about. Because it's very difficult to raise your hand and vote for something you don't even know exactly what it is. But that relates to coalition discipline, which is a terminology which I despise. But you're a member of a coalition in Israel and the government. If the coalition decides that it's voting for a certain law, you do not have the right, you cannot vote against it. If you vote against it, you will be punished by the coalition. You will be stripped of your powers to pass legislation and all kinds of other things. And you have to sort of learn to deal with that. You can abstain. And I did abstain from a few laws where I felt that I could not possibly vote for them. But just the idea that you can't even vote against a coalition law is very difficult. And at times, it put me in difficult positions. But we were never in a situation where I had to vote against anything that was halachic in nature. Those kinds of things, if it ever came up, I was able to abstain. The number one lesson that I learned in my time in the Knesset was something which I wish every Israeli and people around the world could see. You know, I mentioned there are seats over here if anybody doesn't want to stand. I feel uncomfortable that you have to stand. When I used to read the newspaper, the Jerusalem Post, let's say, and I would see what certain members of Knesset were saying and their ideologies, I would say, how is this person even Jewish? How is this person a Zionist? And I would make it personal. And I learned so quickly in the Knesset that what you see on the cameras is not the reality in terms of the personal relationships. There's the room that you see where we meet and we vote and we have these contentious debates. And what you don't see is right behind that room, there's another room where they have couches, they serve us coffee and tea and cake and vegetables. And you can have two members of Knesset who minutes beforehand were standing in the plenum screaming at each other about an issue. And then you go in the back room and they're sitting on the couch. How the grandkids, how's this, how's that? And they're good friends with one another. And you really learn in the Knesset how to separate between the ideological differences and the personal. One of my closest friends in the Knesset is a guy, I'm having a hard time with him now, but I'll explain to you in a moment. His name is Dov Chenin. Dov Chenin is a communist. He's a communist. We have communists in Israel. He's a communist. He's atheist. And he makes me crazy about some of his ideologies. He's a great guy. And we became close friends. And we worked together on environmental issues and other things. I'm having a hard time with him now because he's a member of the Joint Arab List. But in general, I learned that you can go beyond the personal issues. And I'll never forget this classic moment. We were in the middle of this heated debate on the draft law for the Haredim. And the tensions in that room were, I mean, it was so thick. And people are screaming at each other, and they were yelling at each other. And there was a pause in the action because of some technical issue that they were working out. And the moment the pause happened, it was about 9 o'clock at night, somebody went, Mariv! And we all went to this back room, and we all davened Mariv together. And there were even some secular members who put napkins on their heads, and they joined us. And I stood there during that Mariv, saying to myself, Rabbona Shalom, look at this! Look at this! Right? Just moments beforehand, we're at each other's throats about a very important issue, and people believe so strongly in their ideologies, but we're able to join together to daven Mariv. And it was a really important lesson for me, just to see that, to experience that, and I hope that we can do a better job in having broader Israel see that it's that way. One other area that I became very involved with in the Knesset was the area of public diplomacy, making the case for Israel. And that wasn't my mandate when I got to the Knesset. It really was on the Haredi issues, on the religion and state issues, on internal societal issues in Israel. But my second week in the Knesset, I got a call from the Speaker's office, and they said there's a delegation of French members of parliament in the Knesset, and they want me to come and speak to them. I'm the guy who speaks English, right? So I go into this room without any preparation whatsoever, and I started talking about all the wonderful things that are happening in Israel, technology, innovation. There had been some natural disaster that week, and Israel was there, and instead of a field hospital. 3 minutes into my presentation, this member of the French Parliament, also, he bangs on the table. There's a lot of banging on the table in the Knesset. He bangs on the table, and he says, I don't want to hear any more of this. He says, you are building settlements, and because you're building these settlements, the entire Middle East is aflame. And we're here to demand that you stop. Wow, I wasn't prepared for that. So I said to them, and I want to, you know, they know that I'm from a center party. We do believe in trying to find some kind of resolution to the conflict of Palestinians. But to suggest that the entire Middle East is aflame because we're building in settlements, no matter what a person believes, left wing or right wing, that's an outrageous suggestion. So I said to them, does anybody in this room know when the Palestinian Liberation Organization was established? And 20 French members of parliament who are in Israel to pressure Israel into concessions did not know the answer to that question. And I said, 1964. There were no settlements. It was before the Six-Day War. We were not in Yehuda and Shomron. We were not in the West Bank or Gaza. There were no settlements, and this organization was established. Now again, our party does have some criticism towards the government in terms of the policies and certain things and settlements, but to suggest that this conflict is about that, and to then take from that the Middle East is aflame because of that, is something which is unacceptable. And I decided at that moment to make it my mission to travel around to parliaments around the world, especially in Europe, and to be someone who makes the case for Israel. Because regardless of what you think about the government's decisions about this or that, regardless if you're more to the right or more to the left, we are getting a bad rap, and people are totally misleading the general public in terms of the situation in Israel, and someone has to be out there telling the facts as they are. And I realized during those visits just how isolated we are. And by the way, even visits in the capital of this country as well. We're behind closed doors. It's not always as rosy and as friendly as it might seem to the public. And we have to make that our mission. To talk about facts, to talk about Israel does believe in justice, that Israel is a beacon of human rights, and to be there making the case for Israel. The climax of all of these meetings came when I went to South Africa. Every member of Knesset is named as the head of a delegation to another parliament. So all of my colleagues, I was named to head the Knesset delegation to South African parliament. All my colleagues were making meetings with their countries and having delegations and going, and Israel has no relationship with the South African parliament. I could do nothing. There was no starting point. So I met with some experts about South Africa, and I said, is there anything I can do to jumpstart this relationship? And they said to me, if and when Nelson Mandela dies, make sure to be at his funeral, and maybe that can make a difference. Nelson Mandela passed away. I got a call from the Prime Minister's office. Pack your bags, get to the airport. You're flying with the Prime Minister to South Africa. I said, okay. I run to the airport. I'm on my way to the airport, and I got a phone call saying the Prime Minister is not going. In the end, apparently he was afraid that there would be a negative welcome if he came to the funeral. Fine. I go back home. I'm relaxing at home. I got a call from President Shimon Peres's office saying, pack your bags. President Peres is going to South Africa. You're going to fly with him. I said, okay. I was in the middle of packing my bags, and they told me he's not going either. Okay? The Speaker of the Knesset's office called and said, the Speaker of the Knesset is going to South Africa. You'll fly with him. So we rushed to the airport. We're waiting in this lounge in the airport. And I said, what are we waiting for? And they said, we're waiting for permission to fly through African airspace to go. I said, okay, take your time on that one. That's fine. They finally rush us out to this plane. It's a small little jet that we're flying. I don't like flying. I fly a lot, but I don't love flying. And they put us on this small little jet to fly to South Africa. And I said to myself, there's enough fuel in this jet to fly the 9 hours? They said, no, we're landing in Djibouti to refuel. And we get there, as we're landing in Djibouti, they say there's two rules from the government of Djibouti. One is, we cannot get off the plane, because God forbid should any Israeli feet touch their soil. And not only that, we're asked to close the shutters in the plane, because they don't want to even see an Israeli. Think about this. And they're refueling our plane. We got to South Africa. We got to the stadium. And I have to tell you, we got the warmest welcome you can imagine. People were very touched that despite the negative relationship between South Africa and Israel, that we took the time to come. And it taught me an important lesson that, you know, even though doors are closed in front of us, we have to always try. And I got there, I met with some of the members, they invited me to come back as an official guest in their parliament. We had this beautiful photo op with the Israeli flag and South African flag, and we're shaking hands, and then the doors closed, and oh my goodness, did it get vicious in that room. They looked at me, and they told me that we're evil occupiers. They asked me if my son is ever going to serve in the Israeli army. I said, well, my son then was 16 or 17. I said, God willing, yes. And they said, well, that makes your son a baby killer. And they were vicious. And I gave it right back to them, and there was not such pleasantry in that room. And I presented them facts, and I took out materials for them to see about the Hamas charter and some of the actual numbers of the war instead of the inflated numbers about the war. And I told them about I showed them the evidence of the pilot who called off his mission 27 times because there were too many civilians in the area. And in the end, I will not suggest that they walked away as flag-waving Zionists, but there were channels that were open. And now, anytime there's an issue in South Africa of boycotts, of supermarkets, and things like that, I can pick up the phone and call them. And they do understand that that's the wrong approach to take. They do understand that it's a little bit more complex than they might have thought about before. And again, that's the effort that we have to make. We have to be everywhere, all the time, proudly making our case, having the facts, having the ability to articulate our cause as well, which is an issue that we do have somewhat in terms of some of our government officials and representatives, and be everywhere making the case for Israel. All of that activity in the Knesset came to a screeching halt in June 2014. We got word about the boys being kidnapped, then the whole episode until we found out that they were killed, and then we went to war. And all of a sudden, your job as a member of parliament, all that Knesset school goes out the window, and your schedule becomes go to this funeral, go to this hospital to visit soldiers, go to this Shiva house, go to the border in Gaza and meet with soldiers and try to lift their spirits. And as devastating as that time was, because for the first time in my life, I experienced all this up close and personal, it was incredibly inspirational. Incredibly inspirational. I went to the border of Gaza, and I didn't want to go empty-handed, so my mother had raised like $1,000 in Maryland for the soldiers. So I asked my spokesman, Benji, and I said, what can I bring the soldiers? And Benji, who had served in combat in the IDF, he says to me, bring them ice cream. I said, you're kidding me. I'm going to go to Gaza border and bring them ice cream? He said, you asked me, as a soldier, what I would want? That's what I would want. So we called up Ben and Jerry's, and we ordered $1,000 worth of ice cream cups, and we drove down to the border. And if you remember when you get home, you can check on YouTube, just put in my name and ice cream. There's a little video clip of this. And I walk over to this bunker, and I pick up the tarp, and these guys are lying there, and you could see on their faces they had just been through hell of 24 or 48 hours of combat in Gaza, and now they're just relaxing in this bunker. And I said, anybody want any ice cream? and these guys became little children, climbing over one another to get their ice cream. And they asked me, where did this ice cream come from? And I said, people in Maryland. And they said, people in Maryland are thinking about us? I said, yeah. You're not just fighting for yourselves, you're fighting for all the Jewish people. And I saw it with my own eyes, how it just inspired them, uplifted them, gave them a new ruach, a new spirit, to realize that all of Am Yisrael is with them. It was incredible. And we should never be in any more conflicts, but if we are, all of those efforts of sending them packages of things, it makes a difference. As we were driving away, I saw some tanks getting ready to go in, and on one of those tanks, I stopped the car to see what this was. I saw these white papers around the tank. It was pictures that kindergarten students somewhere in North America made for the soldiers. And they received the package of these pictures, and it meant so much to them, they put it all around their tank as they drove into Gaza. Incredible just to see the achdut and the unity and what it means to the soldiers that we're all unified. To go to a funeral and to say to a mother this thing that we say, I'm sorry for your loss. And she looks at me and she says, sorry? She says, never use that word again in this context. She said, I'm devastated. I'll be in mourning for the rest of my life. Nothing will ever be the same. I have a gaping hole in my heart which can never be healed. But she said, I'm not sorry. My son gave his life for the state of Israel, for the Jewish people. I feel nothing other than pride. And never use that terminology of sorry again. And I have to tell you, this is a sentiment which I heard over and over again as we went through that process. And the last part of that experience was the lone soldiers. I got a call that a lone soldier from Texas, Sean Carmelli, was killed. They were nervous that no one would come to his funeral, 11 o'clock at night in a military cemetery in Haifa. And had I not been a member of Knesset, I would not have gotten into his funeral, because all the exit ramps from the highways were clogged with cars, 20,000 people who came to give respect to a soldier who gave up college life in Texas to go and serve in the IDF. And the next day I got a call about another one, Max Steinberg from Los Angeles, and they asked me to call his parents because they had never been to Israel before and explain to them what will be happening when he comes, when they come to Israel. And they asked me to speak at his funeral, and I stood there at Har Herzl, 35,000 people there for his funeral. And I just last week on Yom HaZikaron stood there at his grave with his mother. And she talked over and over again about what it meant to her to have that kind of embrace and to see the kind of people that we are, that 35,000 people come to give respect and tribute to a lone soldier they never heard about, never met, never heard his name, just because of what it meant to them that someone came to fight for Israel. Tremendously inspiring experiences amongst all the sadness. And I have to tell you, just being part of that process of being in the Knesset, being in the parliament, being in the place where you can make a difference in Israel, was nothing short of inspiring and something which I draw inspiration from on a daily basis. People say to me, I'll end with this anecdote, people say to me that my vision for an Israel where there can be unity first and foremost amongst the Jews, where we love each other despite our disagreements, they say, it's stam chalom, it's just a dream. They say that in Israel, where a Jew and non-Jew can get along, that's certainly stam chalom, and making Israel a wondrous society, it's stam chalom. You're this American fresh off the boat. You don't really understand the way things are here. It's not going to happen. It's impossible. So first of all, after just a few years working on it, I see it's not impossible. You have to have a lot more patience than I would realize before. There'll be setbacks along the way, but you celebrate the little victories along the way and realize that it's part of a long, long process. And our country is just 68 years old, and we have a long way to go, and we might not even live to see the changes that we're trying to make, but we're starting that process. That's first of all. But whenever anybody says to me, it's stam chalom, I think about something that happened to me 30 years ago. 30 years ago, I was a young teenager in Maryland, and they brought us to demonstrate outside the Soviet embassy in Washington, D.C. I have no doubt that people throughout this room were part of that process. And we're demonstrating on behalf of our brothers and sisters in Russia. And we used to sing, we would chant, and one of the times they gave out signs for us to hold up, and we stood across the street from the embassy holding up our signs. And I remember it like yesterday. I stood there holding my sign. My sign said, Free Yuli Edelstein. That was my sign. You talk about Stam Chalom. You know, David HaMelech said, Shir HaMa'alot B'Shuv Adonai Shivat Zion Hayinu Kecholmim. That the return of the people of Israel to Zion were like dreamers. 30 years after that, I was blessed to sit as a member of Knesset, and the speaker of the Knesset was Yuli Edelstein. No one's going to tell me that anything is stam chalom, that anything's just a dream. 30 years beforehand, I'm just a regular American kid, not thinking about Aliyah, politics, any of this. And Yuli was languishing away in a prison cell in Siberia. And 30 years later, we're reunited in the Jewish state, in the Jewish capital, in the Knesset. And I have to tell you that my grandmother, may she live and be well, my Bubby and Bar Park, who can't wait to see, God willing, tomorrow, she found the strength to make the trip from New York to Israel. And she came to visit in the Knesset. And she sat there in my Knesset office 70 years after her liberation from Auschwitz. And she said, Dov, this doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. State of Israel, Yerushalayim, Knesset, my grandson is a member of it. It doesn't make any sense. And she's right. It doesn't make any sense. We live in the most incredible of times. We take it for granted. We don't think often enough what will our great-great-great-grandparents have done to breathe the air of Yerushalayim for 15 minutes. What they would have given for that opportunity. And it's been handed to us. Here. Here's Israel. Here's Yerushalayim. Self-determination, the Knesset. And because we live in the most amazing of times, nothing is stam chalom. Nothing is just a dream. We have to believe that we can take the leadership of the state of Israel from the incredible people who founded this state, and we can try to play our role in making this state even better, to work for greater love amongst Jews, to make it a state that's really built on core Jewish values, and to really make it a state which is an Or LaGoyim, which really is a light into the nations. And I believe that Jews around the world together can hopefully work to make that happen. So thank you so much for your time and for listening, and I'll be happy to take any questions. Yes?
I was wondering, given your experience, have you changed your conceptual idea about what a Jewish state is all about?
Yes. The question was, has my idea of what a Jewish state is all about? In my earlier years, I probably would have thought more about halacha playing a role there. And now meeting Israel and understanding what Israel is all about, that it should be based on Jewish values more than anything else. A state which is based on certain values which unify us, which could also be, from that point, values that the whole world can learn from as well. That's narrowing it down to one short phrase or sentence, that's the way I would see it. Yes?
I was curious, at the formation of the government, was there any thought that Yesh Atid of not going into coalition? And do you think, in retrospect, that would have played out for the party?
So for a brand new party to not enter the coalition could be the death knell of the party, because here you are, you're promising certain things. We had five basic promises that we made, and we were able to carry out all five of them in the government. So because we were able to do so, it was worthwhile for us to go in. We did not want the government to fall apart when it did. There's a crazy behind-the-scenes story, which I guess I'll share with you, which no one knows about this. People wonder why that government fall apart. It wasn't because Yesh Atid was insisting on this, and it wasn't because of Yair Lapid's policy for housing. We had 19 seats in the Knesset. The Likud ran in the last elections together with Yisrael Beiteinu. Together they had 31 seats. Likud had 20, and Yisrael Beiteinu had 11. Reuven Rivlin was elected as president, and he had to leave the Knesset from the Likud party. And the next person in line on the list, on the joint list, was from Yisrael Beiteinu. So Likud went down to 19 seats. Yisrael Beiteinu went up to 12. Then Gideon Sar resigned from the Knesset, from Likud. And the next person in line again was Yisrael Beiteinu. They went up to 13. Likud went down to 18. All of a sudden, overnight, Yesh Atid was the largest party in the Knesset, even though it wasn't the ruling party, the prime minister's party. Yaakov Litzman from the United Torah Judaism Party realized that the Haredi parties together had 18 seats. Likud had 18 seats. And he went and he told the prime minister that Yair Lapid met with him and offered to basically collapse the government from within and bring the Haredim into the government and throw the Likud out, and he would be prime minister and topple the prime minister without elections. Now, I can tell you, not only that never happened, it's ridiculous. I mean, to think that Yair Lapid reached out to the Haredi parties to bring them into the government and would have to undo everything we did. But the prime minister got nervous, he got scared about it, and it changed the dynamic of the relationship, and everything fell apart from there. And if you look on the day the government fell apart, the prime minister stood up, and he actually said, there are people in my government who are trying to topple the government from within. And Yair Lapid, in his response, said, do you believe what you're saying? Right? Do you really think that happened? But that was after the behind-the-scenes story. But it was the right thing for us to go in. I'm happy with the changes we were able to make. We didn't have enough time to do everything and to continue things. But like I said, it's part of a process. And now we're polling very, very high in all the polls, 20-plus seats. And whenever elections come, we'll come back very strong and hopefully make a real difference. Yes?
I'm curious about the Arabs in the Knesset. Second largest party now, right? The Unity.
They're not the second largest party, but they're the second party in the opposition. Yeah, they'll
so
join Arab List.
Is there tea and cake with them behind the scenes also?
So good question. With some of them, yes, and some of them, no. There's a difference. Some of them are more moderate. There's an Arab member of Knesset, not in the joint Arab list, but in the Meretz, Asawi Frege. Actually, at the inauguration, I noticed that the joint Arab list members, they weren't a joint Arab list then, they were Arab parties when I was in. They walked out during the national anthem, and Asawi stayed in. And I walked over to them afterwards, and I said, you stayed in, they walked out, what's the story there? And we sat down together, and I actually never thought about this before. We're not changing our national anthem, nobody get nervous, I'm not suggesting that. But he explained to me what it feels like to be an Israeli Arab, even who wants to be an upstanding citizen in Israel, where your national anthem talks about 2,000 years of Jewish aspirations to return to the land. I never thought about this before. It's a fantastic point. Again, we're not changing it, but it shows we have to be ultra-sensitive. If we want the 20% minority to be upstanding citizens in Israel, we have to go out of our way to be sensitive to some of their issues. There were one or two other members of the Arab parties that I was able to work on with certain things. None of them, people who stood at the Knesset podium and said some of the outrageous things that people say. It was very hard for me to hear some of the things that are said. We go so out of our way, you know, for democratic values to let them say things that no other parliament in the world. Whenever I bring a delegation to the Knesset to visit now, I always make sure we go while the Knesset is in session, and I try to time it for when I know that an Arab member is going to be speaking. Because I want them to see it. You want to call us apartheid? You want to call us a country that should be boycotted? Look what's happening over here. And they're shocked by it. They're shocked to see. They stand there openly. And we have a lot of work to do to help the Arab population in Israel. I'll be honest with you. I travel around. I visit villages. There are issues that have to be addressed. And again, we want to have that minority feel like they're citizens in the country. We also have to empower moderate Arabs to be leaders. And it's a big problem, because the leaders they have represent an extremist perspective and a more nationalistic Palestinian side, and that's a shame, because they do have real needs. So there is some camaraderie that's there, but for the most part, there is somewhat of a divide. It's a stronger divide now in this Knesset than it was in the previous Knesset, because they're unified together. By the way, if Labor goes into the government, something which we'll know in about 2 days or so, the leader of the opposition will become member of Knesset Ayman Uda from the joint Arab list. So that's going to be an interesting phenomenon, which happens as well. That's going to be a first for Israel to have to deal with. So. Yes?
In terms of the security issues, are you aligning with the Lapid? And if not, so if that wasn't a big price for you to pay, because there are many times that you need to confronts those issues.
Yeah, I do align with it. I met with Yair, obviously, before I joined, and we talked it through. And once he said that he's against dividing Yerushalayim, and once he said that the Ariel, Gush Etzion, Ma'ale Adumim, and any final settlement would remain in Israel, and once he said that the IDF would retain its positions in the Jordan Valley, and that the IDF can enter anytime they want to in Palestinian areas, those are the basic bullet points that I needed to hear. Otherwise, I do believe it's in Israel's interest to try sincerely to find some way to resolve a very complex and almost impossible conflict. And therefore, I agree with it. I agree with it 100%. And I wouldn't have joined if I didn't feel that way, because I wouldn't be able to deal with that kind of a conflict. And he's stayed true on religion and state issues and on the security issues to all of those points.
Like, for example, when he said that the money is between Netzarim and Itamar, between Ariel and Itamar, that matter.
Yeah.
For me, I felt like as a religious Zionist person, I was insulted personally It was a lie.
Right. Well,
sometimes they say lie.
Right.
It's supposed to make the legitimation.
Right. And the Prime Minister Netanyahu on election day afternoon said Arabs are coming in droves to vote when they weren't, and that turned the whole election into Likud. Sometimes politicians do say exaggerated things, and it's not simple for me. I'm not so good at saying exaggerated things. But his point, I did learn about as a member of the Finance Committee, in terms of high percentages of money that are going towards more isolated settlements where, again, if it's for the security, if it's for people to live there, that's fine. But in terms of expanding them, I don't know if it's the smartest thing for Israel to be doing. And again, do I agree with every single statement that ever says and everything? No. But in terms of the policies and in terms of what we believe in as a party and what we want to see in Israel, I do. And I certainly hope that we can be successful in trying to make those changes. Yes?
Has there been a seat number assigned to you yet?
No. One of the things in our party, which, by the way, I would tell you, the first thing I'll say is this. On election night, it was a strange place to be in when you don't do so well in the elections. And the 11 seats that we got were even less than the polls. We were at 14 or 15 going into election day, and basically the right flank of Yesh Atid flocked to Netanyahu and the left flank flocked to Herzog because of the head-to-head. And, you know, all the young activists were crying all around us, and we were pretty much fine. But Yair grabbed me, and he said, we're together in this, you know, continuing forward. You're not going anywhere. And I'm in touch with him on a regular basis. I'm in the Knesset on a regular basis. The way the list is determined in the Yesh Atid, until 2020, it's by Yair. It's not primaries, which, by the way, I appreciate so much. My colleagues who had primaries in Likud and Bayit Yehudi and Labor, they spend most of their time as members of Knesset raising money, going to bat mitzvahs and bar mitzvahs and weddings and trying to win over votes. And I was able to focus on my job, and there was something really refreshing about that. I was 17 the first time, 17 the second time. It won't be further back than 17. There's reasonable basis to believe it'll be further up, and we'll see in terms of what happens. But I will run again with Yesh Atid. Yair, he wrote a foreword, actually, to my book. It's a beautiful foreword, which stunned me a little bit in terms of how he wrote. But so my official title now in Israel is I'm a Chak Leshavar, which is a former member of Knesset. Whenever he talks about me, he calls me a Chak Bahamtana, a member of Knesset in waiting. So, God willing, that'll happen. If not, there are other ways to serve. You know, people in the media, they ask you, you know, how does it feel not to be in the Knesset? And I always said, you know, I wasn't born a member of Knesset, and I don't need to be a member of Knesset. I want to be there because there's a lot of good that I can do. And I also feel like I was in the middle of so much. That's the hardest part. We were in the middle of so much. You have so many laws going through the process, and all of a sudden it all falls apart and it all stops. That's very frustrating, and I want to go back just to be able to continue a lot of that, and then hopefully the Bible has to show that'll happen. We'll see. Yes?
Yesh Atid get more voters in the next election? Is there a fixed amount that they can't go?
So, it's a great question. A lot of the votes that we're getting now to build higher are actually coming from Labor. What we're doing right now is we're working very hard in Likud. Yair Lapid will go to any house where people say, I can bring you 20 Likud voters, and you tell them. You can scream at him, you can criticize him, it's your moment, Yair Lapid. That's what he's doing all the time. And all the members of the Knesset are out every single night. We get a full schedule every week, and we're doing, you know, retail politics, making our case. And I think we can only really go up. As the third party in the opposition, there's very little to go backwards, unless you have some kind of a scandal. When Yair Lapid offered me to run on the list, he said, Dov, I want to tell you, you don't know this, but you just passed two thorough background checks before he put me on the list, because he wanted to have a party which was clean, and thank God we haven't had any issue whatsoever. No one's been investigated, no scandals of any kind. So I don't see anything that can make us go down. If Labor goes in to the government, I think we're going to skyrocket in terms of the polls, because people will see this election, which was, you know, it's us or them or us, and it was so vicious between Netanyahu and Herzog, and all of a sudden they're together. I think people will, on both sides, Likud and Labor, will come and join with Yesh Atid, and I think we'll go even further. That's our hope, but we're working very hard on it. Yes?
Why did Yair Lapid feel he should be one to bring North down from being in the government, knowing that if he and Herzog left, if he left, the coalition would have to if Bibi won, he would have to rely on a narrow Haredi.
Yeah, he didn't want. We didn't want the government to collapse. The prime minister fired him. We didn't want the government to collapse. We had no interest for that to happen. We even met the day before the prime minister fired him. We met as a party because things were. I mean, that building was crazy during those days. And we met as a party. And we all said we're not going anywhere. We don't believe. And we actually decided what bullet points we want to give the prime minister in terms of where we'll compromise. And we talked about all those issues. And we didn't want the government to collapse. We were in the middle of doing great things in education and other places and all of the process that we were in the middle of. We didn't want the government to collapse at all. Prime Minister fired him.
No, but why?
Because the Prime Minister felt that he was working to undo. The Prime Minister felt that he was trying to topple the government from within.
Right. But
he didn't. Yaakov Litzman, if he was standing right here, he would say, "I made it up to topple the government. That's my job as that position, is to topple the government, and I succeeded." And that's what happened. It just never happened. And the Prime Minister was nervous about his seat, and he fired him for that. That's what happened. Okay, one last question, or we can. Okay.
So you and I spent several years together in Space Federation and Wilson Lane. Right, Sinesky brought up how that 3 years ago there were some significant events that happened. I'm wondering now, after that, how your relationships with Yeshiva, those formative relationships, we both had with the Han Holiday.
Sure.
How does it evolve?
So that day, I was walking down the Knesset hallway, just minding my own business. And a reporter from Radio Kol Barama, which is a Haredi radio station, he puts a microphone in my face and he says, "How does it feel to have your smicha revoked by your yeshiva?" And I have to tell you, I actually almost fainted. I almost fainted. I felt my legs shaking and I had to hold on to this railing. And I said, "What?" He said, "Your yeshiva just revoked your smicha." And I made it back to my office and I called somebody up in the yeshiva right away. And I said, "Did something just happen? Did I just lose my smicha?" And he said, "No, you didn't lose your smicha." I said, "What did happen?" He said, "Let me find out." And he called me back and he says, "I'm pretty upset about this. Somebody told the Rosh Yeshiva that I had said that we have to close down all yeshivas in Israel." And the Rosh Yeshiva walked into the Beis Medrash in middle of Seder, which doesn't happen, anyone who's studying yeshivas, and said, "I have to make a public condemnation," and that's where I was called those names. I asked people in the yeshiva, "What should I do?" There's people in the yeshiva who are very high up, who are very close to my family, who know me very well, and I said, "What should I do?" And they said, "Write a letter to the Rosh Yeshiva." Remember, he's never met me before. He wasn't the Rosh Yeshiva when I was there. The only past we have together is a glowing recommendation that he gave for my first sefer. Glowing, where he wrote things that I wasn't expecting to hear about my book. Ner Yisrael in Baltimore. So I wrote to him, they gave me his email address, and I said, "Shalom Aleichem, my name is Dov Liman, I know we've never met before." I said, "Had we met, you would never would have said the things you said today. Because maybe you'd have disagreement with what I've said, but you would not have called me those names. Just letting you know, I davened twice today in shul, and talis and tefillin, and I learned after davening, and I sat down with my son after school, I learned with him. I went through the whole thing." And the next day, he called the yeshiva together after mincha, and he took back the really bad names, and instead he called me a chote b'shogeg, that I'm an accidental sinner. It did a lot of damage to me on a personal level. Friends of mine would not talk to me after that. Family members, not my closest family, but broader family, disassociated themselves. And it took a long time to try to repair that. The yeshiva never changed any formal statement about it, but I've reached out since then to rabbis in the yeshiva and have met with some of them. And you know, every institution has its politics, and they have their struggles. I will never ever speak out and say one negative word about that yeshiva. It was a yeshiva where my father was there for 8 years and went through college and law school as a young Baal Tshuva, and it gave me so much. And I have only words of appreciation. And the fact that one Rosh Yeshiva spoke out against me is something that, you know, I'll have to deal with. I learned over the years to tune out a lot of the negative. And people say, "Did you see what so-and-so wrote about you?" I don't even notice it anymore. I focus on the positive. And I focus on the Haredi rabbi, who prominent name, who most people in this room have heard the name, who one of his people called me and said he wants to meet with me. And I said, sure, I'll come to his yeshiva. They said, no, don't come to the yeshiva. He wants to meet with you. I said, can I invite him over for dinner at my house? He said, no, he can come to you at 1 o'clock in the morning. And he came to my house at 1 o'clock in the morning in Beit Shemesh and sat with me. And he said to me, he said, Dov, keep doing what you're doing. And here's the line. He said, you're saving us from ourselves. You're saving us from ourselves. And those moments, and the Haredim who are helping get work, and people who constantly, on a quiet level, support, that's what I focus on. And I know that, you know, we're doing the right thing, and we're trying to do things l'shem shemayim, and to make things even better. There's an article that came out today, which you can check online, on the Agaminer website, where I wrote about how Haredi leadership is disgracing Torah. Because last week, they demonstrated all over Israel, they closed intersections, including in Beit Shemesh, to demonstrate over a Haredi boy who was arrested. He was arrested at 2 o'clock in the morning in a lot, going from a nightclub to a bar, and they found him, and he had never even showed up for his Tzav Rishon, which you have to do to show up to the army, because he claimed that he's Torah Toh Umnato. And that's what they were demonstrating for. That exposes the hypocrisy. I want to give kavod to Torah. I want the boys who are really learning day and night to be honored and supported, and they should be the elite of our society, and not that it's just the masses. And I believe that we're disgracing Torah in the way that we're going about it now. So I tune out the negative and just try to focus on the positive and ask for guidance every day from God to make sure that we're trying to do the right things for the right reasons. And hopefully in the end of the process, my goal is that Israel will be filled with Haredi lawyers, doctors, high-tech entrepreneurs, generals in the army, and Israel will be a different country when that happens, because secular Israel will be different as a result, and hopefully that unity can lead to the Geula. Thank you so much.
Thank you once again, Rabbi Lippman. If anyone who's interested, his new book is available for purchase for $50. It'll be admired right now in the Beit Midrash. Rabbi Lippman.